Well, basically, the paradox of success says that when people are focused on the, you know, the right things, then they then it leads to success, right? If those are the right few things at the right time, then it generates success. What it generates as well, which sounds like the right problem to have, is new options and opportunities. And you become the go-to person.
This is Superfast Business with James Schramko. Helping you build your business super fast.
James Schramko here. Welcome back to superfastbusiness.com. Today, this episode is going to blow your mind. But more importantly, it's actually going to put you back into control. It's going to reduce stress, remove chaos, and make life more enjoyable. My guest for today is a New York Times bestseller. I'd love to welcome Greg McKeown. Welcome to the call.
Hey, I'm so happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I took my kid to the motocross park a few weeks back, and I read your entire book, which is Essentialism, The Discipline Pursuit of Less. And while I was sitting there reading it, I just thought, this is ticking boxes the whole way through. Everything that I'm reading, I'm like, yes, 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 yes. And then when I got to the end of the book, I noticed you did something very rare and you actually credited all of the sources, and it was pretty much a summary of my library. So it was it's the best mashup of ideas that I've ever found in one concentrated source, which is kind of ironic since the whole point of your message is less but better. And I just want to say, firstly, as a huge fan of the book, you've done such a great job, and I recommend it to everyone that I encounter because of what's in that book. So thank you for putting it together.
I appreciate that ever so much. Thank you.
It'd be great if you could just give a very brief intro as to how the book came about, because I know that you were writing for the Harvard Business Review, and you must have got some kind of a reaction from what you were publishing to make it into a book.
Yes, that is a part of how it came to be. One of the pieces that I wrote for Harvard Business Review was called The Disciplined Pursuit of Less, and that really did seem to strike a chord to people. I mean, I think that's for a few reasons, but first of all, I think it just has the power of relevancy now. The one thing we need more of is less, and in fact, I think it's quite hard to almost share any other idea with people because they're already so consumed. You know, people feel that they're stretched too thin already at work and at home. They feel like they're saying yes to everyone and everything. They feel like they're making a millimeter progress in, you know, a million different directions. And so I think that it tapped into something in the zeitgeist. And I was in that sense just really very lucky, both with that piece and also with being able to write the book at such a time as this. Yeah.
Well, perhaps if we could just cover some of the key points, we might cherry pick the top ideas. And I think it'd be fairly important to mention the paradox of success. Would you like to explain what you found with that and why it's so important?
Well, basically, the paradox of success says that when people are focused on the, you know, the right things, then it leads to success, right? If those are the right few things at the right time, then it generates success. What it generates as well, which sounds like the right problem to have, is new options and opportunities. And you become the go-to person. People want more from you. And as I said, that sounds like the right problem, but it does in fact turn out to be a problem because, I mean, especially if it leads to what Jim Collins has called the undisciplined pursuit of more. And it often does lead to that. And so exaggerating the point in order to make it, success is a catalyst for failure.
That is quite a paradox.
And so, yeah, it is a paradox. It doesn't sound like that is should be true, but it is. And here's my point of view on it, is that it doesn't mean that we should be anti-success, of course, and I'm not. What it means is that we have to learn how to become successful at success. It means that we have to learn particular principles, particular leadership abilities to be able to navigate that challenge. And I think that everybody has to develop this now, because it's not that just individuals may find their lives, you know, they become successful at something and they have options and opportunities. I mean, it's true that the success paradox applies to one person at a time, given the story of their lives. But it is also true now, broadly, culturally, so that our whole culture in the developed world has fallen into the undisciplined pursuit of more. And so all of us need to apply a very particular set of leadership principles in order to thrive amid that challenge. And so, you know, as in the same way that, for example, Churchill was a particular kind of leader that was relevant at a particular time in history, in a similar way, in a metaphorical way, comparison. To become an essentialist has become the very kind of leadership we need now, personally, and then, of course, in our teams or organizations. We have to be able to figure out what is essential, eliminate what's not as gracefully as possible, and also then be able to reallocate resources in a way to make getting the right things done as effortless as possible. Those are really the three things we have to do. We have to explore what's essential, eliminate what's not, and execute as frictionless as possible.
Great. And when it comes to teams, you're fairly adamant that clarity equals success.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting phrase to pull out of that research. That is what I did, is I interviewed hundreds and hundreds. I mean, I think by the time we were done, we were well over 1,000 data points on this. People had to identify, when have you worked on a team that had high clarity? When have you worked on a team that had low clarity? And what was it like? What were the results? And when you do this visually, as I did with a group at one time, when they looked at the data that they had just produced real time, you know, I said, what do you see? What do you learn? That was somebody's summary. They looked at the data, together, and they said, it says that clarity equals success. And that's interesting, but you see, it's an interesting insight. I think that is what the data showed, but it also comes back to this paradox of success as well, right? When you have clarity, it leads to success. The challenge is to produce new clarity, higher levels of clarity, in the midst of success, and that's not easy to do, because the very nature and force, the gravitational pull of success itself is distracting. It will end up keeping people so busy at their current level of success, just addressing all of the things that are coming their way, that there's no space for them to invest in the next level up. So you see this all the time, that people plateau in their progress, again, individually or as a team, because they've got things going in the right way. That's fine, but they don't break through the next level because they don't get to the next level of absurdly selective criteria, so that they can cherry pick, to use your term from a moment ago, amongst these opportunities and just select the ones that will actually help them to operate at their highest point of contribution.
And it's a process that can be applied in all sorts of things. I guess I've gone from reading an entire Kindle to making my own highlights to straining that down to one piece of paper. And now I'm mindful that our listener may not be fully aware of some of the ideas in your content. And then to actually put forward all the ideas could potentially overwhelm them. And we're probably competing with messages on their phone, social media, updates. How big a problem do you think it is with the environment that we have these days, with the tech and the way that anyone can make content and get to people so easily?
Well, I think that technology makes a good servant, but a poor master. And I think that in today's environment, really, speaking generally, not individually, I think technology is a master, that we don't tend to put it make it our servant. And this is why, because over the last 10 years, as we've shifted from being connected to hyperconnected, we have also shifted from information overload, which we're all familiar with, to opinion overload, which is a different phenomenon. It's a different challenge, because opinion overload is actual people. It's relationships. It's the people in our lives, the people at the periphery, you know, on Facebook, on Twitter, people we either do not know or barely know, being able to get a vote in our lives as to what we should do. So, you know, it's always been true that if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. But in this environment, everybody's got a vote if we're not careful. And so, you know, to sort of put all that into context, what I think is that the social media, the smart technology, the wearables, all of this have progressed so much faster than our skill set has developed. So currently, we are being massively outpaced by the technology that we're being confronted with. I'm optimistic that over time we will develop new skills, that we will adapt in ways that eventually will mean that we know how to navigate these challenges. We will adapt in ways that I think we'll look back into, you know, 2015 and say, can you remember when we were crazy doing this, and this? We would do all these behaviors. And, you know, wow, that was wild, wasn't it, when we felt so addicted? Eventually, we'll adapt past that. But right now, we're playing catch-up for sure.
I have a feeling I've come through that door as someone who was an early user of those things. I'm totally over it, and I've cut down my Facebook to 1.5 hours a week, for example. And I sort of took a twist on one of your phrases. You say that one-time decisions eliminate 1,000 future decisions. I think one-time decision to limit social media eliminates 1,000 opinion fatigues, by the sound of it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I like the idea of opinion fatigues. I mean, I think that's right. And just, it's again, it's about saying, okay, these are powerful tools. How do I want to utilize them? So I'm not saying to people, oh, you should be on Twitter, or you should not be on Twitter, or you should be on Facebook or not be on Facebook. I mean, these are tools like anything, right? They have massive utility for people. I don't think they're going away, although I'm sure they will evolve. The tools themselves will evolve. But I think that our own ability to just create space, so for example, what I do, you know, advocate to people is that they should spend one day every 90 days in a personal quarterly offsite. So that on that day, they're saying, look, I'm just going to review where I've been, especially looking at where I've been successful in doing the things that really matter to me. So that you can have a sense of, no, it is possible. We can make decisions around what's essential. So look for where you've got it right. And number two is to say, look, what's the number one thing I want to do personally over the next 90 days? And what's the one thing I want to do professionally over the next 90 days? And you come out of that experience, that personal course of the offsite, with clarity around that. And also you've had the conversation, maybe a third question is, what are the trade-offs I need to make over the next 90 days to really be able to actually make this as enjoyable experience as possible, getting these items accomplished. And so if someone takes a day every 90 days to do that, they suddenly have a higher level of clarity with which to shape their day-to-day decisions about social media, about email, about what meetings to take, and all the rest of it. You can make the decisions about those things strategically based on the clarity you get at a personal quarterly offsite.
And I think you talk about this in the framework of going big. Perhaps you could explain that when it comes to decision-making and filtering.
Well, I tell you something that comes to mind about that is Warren Buffett. So Warren Buffett, when he was first starting out on his investment journey, he concluded something really smart, which is, I can't be right 1,000 times. He thought, maybe I can be right 20 times, really right 20 times. And he used as a metaphor the idea of a punch card, you know, like almost like a dance card that has 20 punches in it. And he said, that's it. That's my whole investment life is going to be these 20 punches. And so As a result, I'm not going to make small decisions. I'm not going to make little investments here. I'm not going to play around, mess around with a little bit of an idea here, a little bit of an idea there. If I'm doing it, I'm going big. And so that changed his whole approach to investing. It changed it very much into what I would be calling leading as an essentialist. Because what it meant is that because he was only going to go big a few times, he had to explore very broadly. Another paradox of essentialism is that what I found is that essentialists explore more broadly than non-essentialists. And that is because they explore more broadly but commit more narrowly. And so again, using the Buffett example, he's explored all day long, investment portfolio after portfolio, evaluating them constantly until, and he's saying no to all of them, until he finds exactly the right thing. And he goes big, and he keeps it for a long time. Now, that was his philosophy going into his investment story. But now we can also look, how did it work? Well, of course, we know he's the most successful investor in history. But we also can observe that 90% of his wealth comes from just 10 decisions. That's the point, right? An essentialist believes that almost everything is non-essential. A non-essentialist believes that almost everything is essential. They're trying to pursue everything. They're trying to commit and go big on everything. And that's why they don't sleep, and that's why they stay up, and that's why they want to go 24/7 and always want to be available, and a fear of missing out, and all of that is out of the idea that all of it is equally important. But an essentialist says, no, almost everything is meaningless noise. Almost everything is ultimately trivia. A few things really matter. And they are concerned and focused on spending the time to find those few things.
And part of it stems from the very first step of being honest that you cannot do it all. You've just got to have this realization. I think perhaps a lot of people haven't figured that step out yet.
I think that's right. There's a term for that problem, and it's called the planning fallacy, which is one of many brain heuristics. And, a heuristic, of course, is something that has developed or evolved into our minds that has some truth, has some utility, but then there's lots of cases in which it doesn't really work in reality, right? So that it's useful in some cases, not in other cases, but our brains haven't learned to distinguish when to apply that rule and when not to. So the planning fallacy basically says that humans will routinely underestimate how long a task will take. And what's interesting about that is that it's true even when they've done the task many times before. And so, people can relate to this, I think, when they're in the middle of writing an email. And they look at their watch and they say, "Oh, I've got 5 minutes to reach that meeting," and they know that it takes 5 or longer minutes to get there, but they carry on with the email and they say to themselves, "Look, I'll just run there. I'll get there in 2." And they know they can't. And of course, they finish the email and they're going to be late, and they are late, and they run, and they try and make it, but they know it still takes that. It takes 5. But they know how long it takes. This is the planning fallacy. And so you're right. I think that up front, you have to sort of become a little disgusted at non-essentialism. I think you have to look at it, stare at it, and become very dissatisfied with what I believe strongly is a bill of goods that we've been sold, a bad idea, a lie. Yes, a lie. And the lie is, if you can fit it all in, then you can have it all. I mean, there's a few reasons that's a lie. First of all, if you try to fit it all and you don't have it all, you don't get it all, you leave, everyone gets upset at you, everyone's frustrated, you do a bit of progress on everything, you don't do a great job at everything, and you're exhausted all the time. So, first of all, if you try to do it all, it just won't produce the results you've been promised. But also, as you started off this little idea that I've been riffing on, it isn't possible to fit it all in. So that's where the lie begins. You can't fit it all in. You can't fit in half of what you think. As my wife was saying to me the other day, I thought quite a clever little play on words there. Our eyes bigger than our schedules.
So the next logical thought line from that is something I think is worth emphasizing, that certain types of effort yield higher rewards than others. And I know you've drawn from resources like Richard Koch. Most people in my sphere have heard of the 80-20 or a power curve. It's a recurring theme in most modern contexts. But I think people underestimate how different the extra yield is. And that's one of the points that you put forward in the book as well.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Whatever you call it, and there's many, many names for it, and it's been identified in so many fields, it is still routinely underestimated. And so when we wake up in the morning, and I think this is very common for people, they wake up and, first of all, they get into trouble because the first thing they do is they'll check their phone. And there, it all starts there. The sense of reactivity starts there. And it's not just reactive. The essence of the problem isn't just that somebody feels busy all day. The essence of the problem is that it all feels approximately the same level of importance. That is the problem. We get into believing it's all a priority. It's all important. It all has to be done. And that's overwhelming. It's challenging. You can see how far we've come when you just think about the word priority itself. You know, it came into the English language in the 1400s and it was singular. Priority, the very first, a very prior thing. That is what it meant. And very sensibly, it stayed singular for the next 500 years. And it was only in the 1900s, as a result of the industrial revolution and a set of thinking that came in with that, that somebody started to pluralize the term. That somehow we can have very, very many very first or before everything else things. And, we can't. That's a complete nonsense.
Tell me about one of the great tools to help working out which things have the higher yield activity or not would be the definite yes or else no philosophy. It's probably worth mentioning that one.
Yeah, this is... Because this is true, the challenge is for capable, driven, successful people, the challenge is to discern between the good and the great. I think most people can discern, especially if they create any space to think, they can discern between the complete waste of time and something that's really important. But where we get into trouble is in the fuzzy middle. And so I recommend that people can actually make this decision strategy quite concrete by making a list of all the options and then going down each of them and saying sort of on a scale of 1 to 100, a percentage, how much of a yes do you want to do this? How right does this feel? And as you do that, some things will be 10%, right? You say, no, they are not the right thing. I should not be doing those things. That's not where my focus should be. And then some of these will be like, 90% or above. They're like, these are definite yeses. These are the right thing. And those, those sort of polarized options are easier. What's harder is when you have something that's 50%, 60%, 70%, 80% yes. And that's where we often have our resources absorbed. And the problem is, given what we were just talking about with the planning fallacy, is that we don't actually have time to do the 70%, 80%, 90%, 80% work and the ones that are definite yeses. And so my challenge to people is get the things that are 90% to 100%, and then everything else you just pretend it's zero. So if it's something 70, you just go, that's a zero. If it's 80, it's a zero, and see what you're left with. But you can always, if you say, well, I'm not left with anything, there are no 90 or above options here. Maybe you say, okay, well, I'll reduce my criteria, go to 80% and above and see what you're left with. But often what I've found when I do it is that what is 90 and above will consume me. To achieve those objectives in a given day or a week or indeed 90 days or a year, those will actually take all the available energy and time I have. And I just feel so much better to be able to invest those on the things that are clearly yes. So it's no more, yeah, sure. It's absolutely yes, or no, we're not doing it.
Craig, that's a great philosophy. Now, there are plenty of things that we could discuss, and I'm super respectful of your time. And I think in the spirit of essentialism, We're going to keep this episode tight. So I might just do a little summary and we'll make sure that we summarize the key points we've discussed. And the first one is that we're going to be more successful at being successful to avoid the paradox of success. We will acknowledge that we can't do it all. We'll also manage our tech environment so that we're the master and not the servant. We're going to work out what's essential by doing more research and putting things through the high yield filter using a yes or no approach. And once we've got that one thing or the most essential thing, then we're going to execute. We're going to have a 90-day review point. We're going to be very clear on the one thing we'd like to achieve, and everything else will subordinate around that, because we're going to make one-time decisions that eliminate thousands of future decisions. And then we're going to get on with our routine. Now, some of the areas we didn't cover that I think would come up when our listener goes and reads the book, which I highly recommend, and I'll put a link to it right here, Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. They're going to find out about editing, play, sleep, pause, and journaling. And they're things that I'll let the listener discover on their own. So in summary, is that a fair assessment of how someone might get started, having just listened to this episode, Greg?
I think that's exactly right, yeah.
Perfect. Well, I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming along to the call, because I know that I've got very tight scheduled blocks in my calendar and the rest of the time's my thinking time, and I'm sure that that's the case for you. In fact, the fact that you even came to the podcast meant I must have passed some kind of filter, and I hope it was worthwhile for you as well.
Thank you ever so much for having me. Yeah.
Where can our listeners go find out more information about you, aside from buying your book on any of the top bookstores?
Yeah, you know what I would say? We're very excited. I'm very excited about having spent the last year trying to answer the question, what is the best way to become an essentialist? And finally, we've cracked the code on it, and we're launching a program called Essential. Essential. And people, we're actually looking for people to apply to the program right now. This is for people who are really serious about trying to apply these ideas and become a real essentialist in their lives. And so they're going to get together. I'm going to lead the program, and the people that come, we're going to have them get together every 90 days for a personal quarterly offsite, which we just mentioned, for a year. And it's going to be this adventure to try and apply these things. We know that it's a process. That's what I've learned. I mean, it's a process, not an event. And so often learning is sort of, you just do it one time and read something, or you go to some class and then it's over. So we think having it as an ongoing journey is the way to approach this. And so people can go to applyessential.com. Applyessential.com and apply, and then we're going to work way through those applications and find a group that we think really works.
Fantastic. What a great opportunity. And from my experience, you're on a winner there. That's exactly how my mastermind works, is 12 weekly review points on an ongoing and perpetuity basis, actually. It does get phenomenal results. So our lucky listener could go along to applyessential.com, and if they're successful, I'm sure their life is going to become chaos-free with your help, Greg. Thank you so much for putting aside the time with us.
Thank you ever so much. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Discover how to build your business super fast. Check out superfastbusiness.com.